our Neurology Revision Guide, part of our Finals Countdown series brought to you by MedTalks. I'm Bharad Waj and I'm currently a junior doctor working in the East Midlands. It's with a heavy heart I inform you that we're coming to the end of the Neurology Guide, after which you're on your own as you put your skills to the test and fulfil your true action potential. We've covered all manner of topics over the course of this series, from neuroanatomy and spinal cord disease to the common neurological conditions you're likely to be examined on, from strokes to seizures and everything in between. Last time we began to talk about the neurology OSCE stations and looked at how to perform a cranial nerve examination. Today we're going to go through the other OSCE stations that may potentially come up. We're going to start by talking about the upper limb neurological examination, and next time we're going to focus on the lower limb and cerebellar examination. Essentially, the purpose of the limb exams is for you to try and figure out where in the brain the lesion is likely to be, and at the most basic level, whether the patient has an upper or lower motor neuron lesion. As a quick recap, upper motor neuron lesions are likely to originate in the brain and spinal cord, whilst lower motor neuron lesions involve the nerve roots, peripheral nerves, neuromuscular junctions, and muscles. There are characteristic differences between how upper and lower motor neuron lesions may present. On inspection, you may observe wasting and fasciculation in the case of lower motor neuron lesions, but not in the case of upper motor neuron lesions. Similarly, tone may be decreased in lower motor neuron lesions, but increased in the case of upper motor neuron lesions. Lower motor neuron lesions may present with absent or reduced reflexes, whilst upper motor neuron lesions are characterized by exaggerated reflexes. Both upper and lower motor neuron lesions may present with weakness, but the pattern of distribution is often different between the two. So, upper motor neuron lesions may classically manifest as pyramidal weakness, wherein the extensors are weaker than the flexors in the arms, but the flexors weaker than the extensors in the legs. The pattern of weakness in a lower motor neuron lesion, on the other hand, depends on where specifically is affected. So, peripheral neuropathies may classically present with more distal weakness, whilst pathology affecting the muscles, such as polymyositis, may present as proximal muscle weakness. Right, so now that we're all warmed up, let's get stuck in with the exam itself. Today, we'll start by going over the upper limb exam, and then next time we'll talk about the lower limb exam and the cerebellar exam. The equipment you'll be needing for both the upper and lower limb neuro exam is a 128Hz tuning fork, so the big one, a neuro tip, a wisp of cotton wool, and a tendon hammer. The first part of any OSCE examination can be remembered by the mnemonic WIPE. Wash your hands, introduce yourself to the patient, position the patient appropriately, explain the examination and obtain consent. The ideal position would be to have the patient reclined to 45 degrees on the examination couch. You'd also want to expose the patient appropriately. For the upper limb examination, you're going to want to inspect both arms up till the shoulders. So, depending on what they're wearing, they might just be able to roll their sleeves up or have to remove their top altogether. Similarly, for the lower limb examination, you'll want to inspect all the way up to their thighs, so you may need to ask them to remove their bottoms. Usually though, for the sake of the OSCE, the patient will already be wearing shorts or a sleeveless top. However, if you do find yourself having to expose the patient, be sensitive how you do it. You're not just being marked by the examiner, but by the patient too for how comfortable you make them feel. So for example, if you've been asked to examine both the upper and lower limbs, don't ask them to expose their top and bottom half straight away. Perform either the upper or lower limb exam first and expose the patient appropriately. Allow them a moment to get dressed again when you've finished, and then proceed with the next exam. It's simpler enough to do, but also simpler enough to forget to do in the heat of the moment, but can go a long way towards making your patient feel more comfortable. The first part of the upper limb examination involves inspecting the patient. Perform a general inspection from the end of the bed, looking for any gross abnormalities or paraphernalia by the bedside, such as mobility aids. Then perform a closer inspection of the patient's limbs. Look for any scars which may suggest previous surgery, any muscle wasting, fasciculations or tremor. You can also comment on the presence of any abnormal movements, such as chorea, myoclonus and tardive dyskinesia. A good mnemonic to help you remember what to look for is WIFT, which stands for wasting, involuntary movements, fasciculations, and tremor. A good general test to do is to look for the pronator drift test, which may be suggestive of upper motor neuron disease. This involves asking the patient to close their eyes and have their hands outstretched with palms facing the ceiling. If the patient is observed to pronate their arm on either side, this is known as a positive pronator drift test and implies a problem with the contralateral pyramidal tract. In an upper motor neuron lesion, the supinators of the forearm are weaker than the pronators, and hence you might observe this pronation. Next, move on to assessing the tone of the upper limbs. Remember to inquire if the patient has any pain anywhere before doing this. Ask the patient to fully relax their arm and support the weight of their arm in your hands. So, if you're examining their right arm, take their right hand into your right hand, as if you're giving them a handshake, and use your left hand to support their right elbow. Passively move each of their muscle groups through its full range of motion, so full circumduction of the shoulder, flexion and extension of the elbow, and full circumduction of the wrist. Comment on the tone. Is there reduced tone or hypertonia, suggestive of a lower motor neuron lesion, or is there spasticity or rigidity? On the subject of spasticity versus rigidity, the main thing to note is that spasticity is typically seen in the context of a pyramidal tract pathology, such as a stroke, and is velocity dependent, i.e. the faster you move the arm, the worse the tone. This occurs up to a point, after which there is a sudden reduction in the tone, known as the clasp knife response. Rigidity, on the other hand, implies extrapyramidal tract disease and is velocity independent, i.e. it feels the same irrespective of how quickly you move the limb. Classically, you might observe cogwheel rigidity in the context of Parkinson's disease, which occurs due to a tremor superimposed on the hypertonia. Both spasticity and rigidity are typically best observed on pronation and supination of the patient's forearm. Once you've assessed the tone of the upper limbs, move on to examining the power across their various muscle groups. In practice, you'll see doctors do a very gross, rough assessment of power, but for the sake of the OSCE, it's important to be systematic and thorough in your examination. You can use the Medical Research Council or MRC scale of muscle power to grade the extent of the patient's weakness. This is a scale from 0 to 5, where 5 denotes full power. 4 is when the patient is able to move their joint against both gravity and on applying resistance. 3 is when there is weakness against resistance, but movement is preserved against gravity. For example, they're able to actively abduct their shoulder out to the side, but you're then able to passively adduct their shoulder back to their side despite their efforts to resist. MRC grade 2 is when movement is preserved when gravity is eliminated, for example, from side to side against the bed. 1 is when there's only a trace or flicker of contraction, and 0 is when there's no contraction at all. When assessing power, it's important to stabilize and isolate the joint as best you can to stop other muscle groups from compensating. You should also assess one side at a time. Start by assessing shoulder abduction and adduction. To check for shoulder abduction, ask the patient to flex their elbow and bring their arms out to the side to 90 degrees, and then try to push down on the lateral part of each arm in turn while asking them to resist. To check for adduction, ask them to bring their arms out to 45 degrees, still with their elbows flexed, and try to abduct each arm in turn whilst asking them to resist. You could say something like, "Okay, Mr. Smith, if you could please bend your elbows and bring your arms out to your side like a chicken. Don't let me push down. Now if you could bring your arms slightly closer to you, don't let me pull them out to the side." To assess elbow flexion and extension, ask the patient to bring their arms out in their front with their elbows flexed to about 90 degrees. To check for flexion, attempt to extend each elbow in turn against resistance. And to check for elbow extension, attempt to flex each elbow in turn against resistance. So for this, you could say, "Okay, Mr. Smith, please bring your arms out in front of you like a boxer. Don't let me pull your arm away from you. And now don't let me push your arm towards you." To check the power in the wrist, ask the patient to again bring their arms out in front of them and to make a fist with their palms facing towards the floor. To check for flexion, ask them to fully flex their wrist and attempt to extend the wrist against resistance. To check for extension, ask them to cock their wrist back as you try and flex their wrist against resistance. So you could say, "If you could please bring your arms out in front of you and make a fist with your palms facing downwards. Now point your wrist to the ground and don't let me pull it up. And now cock your wrist back and don't let me push them down." It's good practice to try and test like for like, i.e. to compare the patient's muscle group you're testing against your corresponding muscle group. So for example, when you're testing the patient's wrist flexion, make your hand into a fist too when you're trying to pull their wrist up, so that you're comparing their wrist flexors with your own. Moving on to the hands, you're going to want to test finger extension, finger abduction, and thumb abduction. To check for finger extension, ask the patient to again bring their arms out to their front, with their palms outstretched and facing the floor. Attempt to push down on the dorsal surface of their fingers with your index finger against resistance. To check for finger abduction, ask them to spread their fingers out as you attempt to adduct first the index finger and then the little finger against resistance. And to check for thumb abduction, ask the patient to supinate their arm and point their thumb to the ceiling as you attempt to push down on their thumb and bring it into their palm whilst asking them to resist. Remember again the importance of stabilizing the wrist joint whilst you do this, and to check their muscles against your corresponding muscle, their thumb against yours, and their fingers against yours. So as an example, you could say, Mr. Smith, please could you bring your arms out in front of you with your palms outstretched and facing down? Don't let me push your fingers down. Now, if you could splay your fingers open for me, don't let me push your index finger in. And now don't let me push your little finger in. And now if you could turn your hand over and point your thumb to the ceiling, don't let me push your thumb down into your palm. Remember again that in the case of an upper motor neuron lesion, you would expect a pyramidal pattern of weakness. So the extensors in the upper arm would be weaker than the flexors. And in a lower motor neuron lesion, meanwhile, only the muscles innervated by the damaged nerves would be affected. Each of these movements are, of course, not without purpose, as you're testing a range of nerves and muscles. So you may want to go away and brush up on your myotomes and muscles of the upper limb. Don't want those second year anatomy notes to go to waste after all. Coraco brachialis and abductor pollicis brevis, anyone? Once you've assessed the power, move on to eliciting the reflexes in the upper limb. A good mnemonic to help you remember the tendon reflexes and the corresponding nerve root in both the upper and lower limbs is S1-2, buckle my shoe, L3-4, kick the door, C5-6, pick up sticks, C7-8, lay them straight. So the ankle reflex tests S1 and 2, the knee jerk reflex tests L3 and 4, the biceps and brachioradialis reflex tests C5 and 6, and the tricep reflex tests C7 and 8. It's a good variant of the much loved nursery rhyme to teach your nephew if you want to give them a head start on their neuroanatomy practice. We'll start then by talking about the upper limb reflexes and come back to the lower limb ones later. To elicit the reflexes, try to ensure the patient's arm is as relaxed as possible. Hold the tendon hammer right at the end and allow it to just swing through the air like a pendulum. To check the biceps reflex, place your thumb over the biceps tendon, which can be found in the patient's antecubital fossa, and gently strike the tendon hammer against your thumb. Look for a contraction in the biceps tendon, although in practice what you're really looking for is a reflexive flexion of the elbow. Similarly, for the supinator or brachioradialis reflex, locate the brachioradialis tendon, which is approximately 4 inches proximal to the base of the thumb on the posterolateral aspect of the forearm. Place 2 fingers over the tendon, and as before, strike the hammer against your fingers and look for a contraction of the brachioradialis muscle, as well as a reflexive supination of the forearm. For the triceps reflex, ask the patient to rest their arm on their lap with the elbow flexed to 90 degrees and locate the triceps tendon, which can be found just superior to the olecranon process of the ulna. Again, tap the tendon with your hammer and look for a contraction of the triceps muscle and extension of the elbow. Remember, as we've already said, in upper motor neuron disease, such as stroke and spinal cord lesions, you can expect to see brisk reflexes. In lower motor neuron diseases, meanwhile, such as peripheral neuropathy, you may see absent or reduced reflexes. That's that then on the motor components of the upper limb neurological examination. You'll be pleased to hear that the sensory examination is distinctly less onerous and involves assessing the patient's sensory dermatomes using a modality that examines both the spinothalamic tract and dorsal column pathway. If you cast your mind all the way back to the first episode of this series, you'll recall that the spinothalamic pathway is responsible for pain and temperature sensation, whilst the dorsal column pathway is responsible for fine touch, proprioception or joint position sense, and vibration. Ah, don't you just love it when we come full circle? Accordingly, your weapons of choice for the sensory exam should be a wisp of cotton wool to check for fine touch, a 128Hz tuning fork to check vibration sense, and a neurotip to assess pain sensation. You're going to have to do the thankless task of relearning your dermatomes, though, before doing your sensory examination, to make sure that all dermatomes are assessed thoroughly. To help you through, C5 can be assessed on the lateral surface of the deltoid muscle, also known as the regimental badge area. C6, 7, and 8 can be checked on the palmar surface of the thumb, middle finger, and little finger, respectively, and T1 can be examined in the antecubital fossa. To assess pain sensation, so the spinothalamic tract, ask the patient to close their eyes and touch their sternum with a sharp end of a neurotip to establish their baseline. Then systematically assess each dermatome in turn, comparing both sides as you go along. Repeat again with a wisp of cotton wool, which, remember, assesses the dorsal columns. If you observe a loss of sensation distally on one side, take care to check first sensation on the opposite side and then work your way more proximally, as bilateral glove distribution sensory loss and stocking distribution in the case of the lower limbs is strongly suggestive of a peripheral neuropathy, as seen in diabetics or individuals with a history of excessive alcohol consumption. Vibration sense, meanwhile, also involves the dorsal columns and involves striking a 128Hz tuning fork and placing it first against the patient's sternum and then against their most distal bony prominence, so their interphalangeal joints. If you're able to feel the vibration of the tuning fork at the most distal eminence, you can be confident that their vibration sense is preserved. If they can't, however, keep moving proximally, for example, to the metacarpophalangeal joints and then the carpometacarpal joints, until the vibration is felt. As we've already said, the dorsal columns are also responsible for proprioception, which can be assessed by asking the patient to close their eyes and taking their thumb between your thumb and index finger and moving it either up or down and ask the patient to tell you the direction of movement. Importantly, hold the thumb by its sides and not on the nail bed, as patients may be able to ascertain the position of the thumb by the pressure applied. You may need to assess more proximal joints if the patient cannot correctly tell you the direction distally. There are a bunch of characteristic patterns of sensory loss that you should probably reluctantly go away and recap. Mononeuropathies may result in sensory disturbance in the area supplied by the damaged nerve, for example, whilst peripheral neuropathies may produce a glove and stocking distribution of sensory loss, as we've already said. Radiculopathies may occur due to nerve root damage, such as disc herniation, and cause sensory impairment in the associated dermatomes, whilst spinal cord damage may produce sensory loss both at the level of and below the lesion. And lastly, thalamic lesions, as in a stroke, may produce contralateral sensory loss. The final component of the upper limb sensory exam you should examine is coordination. This involves two special tests, the finger-to-nose test and checking for dysdiadochokinesia. To perform the finger-to-nose test, place your finger at the patient's eye line an arm's breadth away, so that they have to fully extend their arm to reach your finger. Ask them to touch the tip of their nose with their index finger, followed by asking them to touch your finger. Ask them to repeat this movement a few times and do the same again on the other side. Past pointing, where the patient overshoots when attempting to touch your finger with theirs, is suggestive of impaired coordination or dysmetria, as seen in ipsilateral cerebellopathology. Similarly, the presence of an intention tremor, in which the patient does not have a tremor at rest but is observed to do so on use, is also suggestive of cerebellar disease. Dysdiadochokinesia also checks for cerebellar ataxia and involves asking the patient to place an arm out in front of them with their palm facing the ceiling and then place the opposite palm on top. Get them to rapidly pronate and supinate the palm on top and observe for speed and fluency. Ask them to switch arms and do the same again. Slow, irregular movements are suggestive of ipsilateral cerebellar disease. That about does it for the upper limb neurological examination. Needless to say, you should finish the exam by thanking the patient for their time, assist them in getting dressed again, and wash your hands. Next comes everyone's favourite, the summary. You should open your summary with a general assessment of your patient's general comfort and appearance, outline the main positive findings and key negatives of your exam, and suggest relevant next steps in your investigation and management. So, as an example, you could say something like, "Today I performed an upper limb examination on Mr. John Smith, a 58-year-old gentleman. Mr. Smith was generally comfortable at rest, and there was no gross muscle wasting or additional movements observed, or any paraphernalia by the bedside suggestive of neurological disease. There was no motor dysfunction, and power, tone, and reflexes were preserved across all muscle groups. My main positive finding was a bilateral distal sensory loss across both pain and temperature modalities extending to the wrist. This is in keeping with a peripheral neuropathy likely due to diabetes or chronic alcohol consumption. To complete my examination, I would like to examine the lower limbs and cranial nerves and obtain a full history inquiring specifically about alcohol consumption and diabetic history. Relevant next steps would include a full set of bloods, including HbA1c levels to assess glycemic control, consider neuroimaging and nerve conduction studies, and risk factor modification. I think we'll probably call it a day there on this episode of MedTalks. I hope you found it a useful recap on the upper limb examination and its various components. Next time, we'll consider the lower limb neuro exam and cerebellar exam. Both of these are similar to what we've already discussed and outline the same principles, so hopefully should be altogether less taxing. Until next time, this is me tuning out. Thanks.